This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. This week we react to the Champions League. Very good results for both Liverpool and Manchester City. But what will Paris Saint-Germain and their star man Kylian Mbappe have to say about whether they're the best teams in Europe right now? We'll also ask if Bayern Munich are the dominant force that they once were. We get an update on the owner's charter in the Premier League and look ahead to some great ties in the Europa League. This is The Game. Hello again, I'm Hugh Wisencroft. Welcome back to The Game. I'm alongside Tom Clark, and Ian Hawkey joins us, of course, because European football is back with the Champions League. Let's start with last night's action. Liverpool winning the first leg of the last 16 tie at Inter Milan 2-0 thanks to goals from Roberto Firmino and Mo Salah, navigating with some comfort in the end what looked to be a very tricky fixture. Ian, what was key to Liverpool's win for you?
Well, the changes, the substitutions. I mean, you know, the manager looks very astute for the changes he made and when he made them, because you know there was a period, wasn't there, where Inter really had some sustained pressure and Liverpool looked like they didn't know how to get out of it, and then on came Henderson and Firmino, obviously decisively, and you know a really good set piece, which is something that they know how to do. You know, they are the better of the two sides. But I think, I think the manager can probably take quite a lot of credit for getting themselves out of a bit of a hole. And yeah, I think they should be safe now. The only thing is, I mean, Inter will feel pleased with an hour they put in that game. And they will also remember that Liverpool in recent years under Klopp have had a couple of slightly chaotic second leg, haven't they, in the Champions League? Remember Roma 2018, and of course Atletico Madrid. So you know there's possible precedents where Liverpool might not be in such control. But I just think they're a more mature side, and they've got more strength and depth than they did 2 years ago or 5 years ago. So yeah, I think that's done.
Ooh, I wouldn't say it was done, Ian. That's a bold call. 2-0, most difficult lead in football, isn't it? That's the cliche, isn't it? I thought it was interesting from the point of view of two of the things that Ian mentioned there, because it links to some of the things that we've done to cover the game. Tom Roddy's written a piece from Milan talking about Liverpool's kind of strength in depth, which I think is quite telling in the big competitions this season. For a while, and there was lots of discussion last season, wasn't there, about the gap between their first 11 and how strong that was. You always knew what Liverpool's best team was if it came to a big match or to a cup final. But then the kind of replacements, the stand-ins, weren't as good. And I think, as Ian touched on there, the fact that he picked Harvey Elliott, you know, very, very talented player, and it's amazing that he was starting a Champions League game after that injury, of course, but wasn't his best performance. But they can change it up and they can bring players on that can make a difference. I think that's a really telling thing for Liverpool this season. And set pieces, we've got a fascinating piece from Paul Joyce that'll be on Times website later today, talking about the work that they did in pre-season with a company called Neuro 11, which, and there's a fascinating video with it on YouTube as well, that Liverpool players were kind of fitted with this kind of kit that they wore around their head. And then they took penalties, free kicks, corners, and it was all about measuring their kind of composure, if you like, all sorts of complicated scientific metrics that you'll have to read Paul Joyce's piece, because he explains it far better than I do. But it was fascinating in terms of Klopp looking at where they maybe weren't as good and looking to improve them. We know they're great at counter-attacking. We know that they're great at pressing and nicking the ball back and scoring goals. And then he looks to add something else. And it's telling. They've scored 14 goals from set pieces in the Premier League. That's the most of any team. And now with Firmino's goal last night, they've scored 5 from set pieces in the Champions League, which is the most of any team as well. So those two things to me suggest more of a kind of ruthless, efficient Liverpool, which, as Ian says, it kind of slightly contrasts the slight kamikaze, hectic nature of some of their Champions League performances in the past.
You've got to be amazed by Liverpool, who've played such an incredible style of football for so long. I heard an incredible stat about the number of offsides against Liverpool with their high defensive line. I think, you know, it's like 40% higher than any other team in terms of catching players offside in the Premier League so far. Their defence was excellent. Inter Milan didn't have a single shot on target in the entire game. Joel Matip is usually their unsung hero in central defence, but he was actually replaced for this game by Ibrahima Konate, 22 years old. We said he was a star in the making at Leipzig, but actually, given he's had a little bit of time out of the starting lineup on his arrival at Liverpool, he's come back into it and he actually seems to have gone on a step, Ian. He was fantastic last night.
Yeah, I thought he was absolutely terrific, you know, doing the old-fashioned stuff, getting in the way. Good to have a partner like Virgil van Dijk, who was also outstanding, I thought, last night. And yeah, I mean, another, along with Luis Diaz, another tick in Liverpool's recruitment strategy. The thing I would say, without being overcritical about Konate, is that you'd like to think that there's a little bit of room for improvement with his distribution and, you know, his willingness to be sort of daring with longer passes and mastering that. But, you know, he's got plenty of time to work on that. But it is an important part of the way Liverpool play. So you know, I think if he masters that, then, you know, he's in with a shout of being Van Dijk's preferred partner.
Absolutely, he is. I mean, I looked at the bench. They showed pictures of the bench last night. Jurgen Klopp, but sitting behind him, Joe Gomez, you know, a figure who, at the start of the season, he was complaining, wasn't called up for England in the shape of Joe Gomez. But Jurgen Klopp can't be angry anymore. In fact, you probably think his future is away from Liverpool at this point in time. Which is a bit of a side note, because I think actually on the evening, it was very important that Liverpool especially got the second goal. Great bit of poachery from Mo Salah. Do you think, Tom, the tie is now done then?
I don't think it's quite done yet, because whilst, as you say, Inter didn't have a shot on target, they did obviously hit the bar. I think they have players, you know, Edin Dzeko, to me, one of the great underrated strikers of the modern era. He's always got the chance to convert, you know, a Salah-type goal if it drops to him in the box. And if they can do that in the first half of the return leg, then it's game on. What I would say is that with Liverpool, you always think that they will score as well. So that's the problem for Inter now. They have to come out and try and attack the game, and then it just plays perfectly into Liverpool's hands.
A team that's definitely going to have to attack in the second leg is Sporting Lisbon. I mean, they've got to come out fighting from the start, don't they? You've got to say Manchester City all but confirmed into the last day. An incredible 5-0 win in Lisbon for them. Ian, they terrorised the Sporting defence. Was this for you the sort of result that sends a massive warning sign to the rest of Europe, or in many ways was it a mismatch?
Well, yes, I mean, it was a bit of a mismatch. The one thing I would say, and you know, this is not to, you know, sound patronising, and I only saw it on television, but I thought the Sporting fans were amazing. You know, they were still there making noise. And actually, if you look at the recent history of that club, you know, they can be, well, sections of the Sporting fans can be a fairly combative lot when they don't approve of what's going on. It was, I don't know, it just seemed to me like a quite a sort of heart-rending display of loyalty and you know, where you'll never walk aloneness. But yeah, I mean, it was a mismatch, wasn't it? And, you know, Sporting did, unfortunately, look like a club who haven't been in this territory for a very long time, which they haven't. And they were up against an absolutely rhapsodic City at times, weren't they? Yeah, you know, clearly City are the team to be feared. And I would say that, you know, that there might be more of this. Sporting are the champions of Portugal. Inter are the champions of Italy. And next week we've got the champions of Spain against Manchester United, who aren't always rhapsodic, but, you know, have a chance in that and the champions of France up against Chelsea. So brace yourself for quite a lot of Premier League breast beating by the end of this round, I think.
Firstly, I've just got to mention probably the best goal. This is a half volley. Those of you that need adjudication, Bernardo Silva's first goal was unbelievable. I think this is the thing about Manchester City, especially playing against Sporting. Maybe they didn't get the TV audience going up against PSG Real Madrid. What a goal. What a great performance, Tom, from Silva as well.
Absolutely. Well, he's continuing to stake that claim, isn't he, for your hipster alternative view for player of the year instead of Mo Salah. As you say, I mean, I'm with you. I don't know about you guys. Give me a half volley over a volley any day in terms of that way that they players have to strike the ball and they kind of arrow into the goal. You know, there's no dip, there's no deviation. It's a beautiful thing to watch. I mean, I'd be interested to know, obviously, because in terms of the game, you would suggest that the tie is over. I mean, Ian, I can remember, and Hugh, I'm sure you're the same, for kind of a few generations ago, English fans in European football, the fear was always Real Madrid or Barcelona. And then for a while, and perhaps it still is, Bayern Munich as well. In Europe and in Spain, are City and Liverpool now viewed as those two teams? Are they the teams that everyone goes, God, we're not going to stop them?
Yes, and I think this season, until maybe last week, Bayern Munich, you know, I think there's a sort of consensus that going into this stage of the Champions League, City, Liverpool, Bayern, and a little bit behind Chelsea as the favourites, but you know, clearly Bayern have had a little bit of a stumble. So yeah, I would say Liverpool and City generally viewed as quite a way above the rest. Although a new acknowledgement, I think, of PSG after Tuesday night, not quite the flaky team that people suspected.
Well, Ian, take it easy. Not flaky. They might have won the game. It should have been four. This tie shouldn't have even been in the balance. You know, we're talking about Liverpool and Manchester City being the best two sides in Europe. They wouldn't have let Real Madrid get out of there with a 1-0 defeat. And it was a fortunate goal. It was an awful piece of defending. It had a little nick off Valverde's foot to nutmeg Courtois. And I'm not saying it wasn't a deserved victory. But if PSG get knocked out 2-1, say, on aggregate, and it doesn't go their way back in Spain, they will only have themselves to blame. And I will be telling you, it was flaky from them to be knocked out. We're only halfway through, Ian, but all I'm going to say is it could have been, but it wasn't the perfect night for PSG. Am I wrong?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, I think you have defined flakiness superbly. And, you know, I misused the word. Yeah, no, absolutely right in most things. They should have won by more. Courtois was terrific, you know, until he got nutmegged rather unfortunately at the end. I think to describe the winning goal as entirely fluky might be an exaggeration. You know, a lot of very good work went into it from the outstanding player on the night. And, you know, Mbappe is really good at this, really good at settling games in favour of a previously flaky Paris Saint-Germain close to the end. So, you know, he's become an expert at that. But yeah, you're right. You can easily see Real Madrid, although they will be without Casemiro, which is important, and without Ferland Mendy suspension. You could see them conjuring up some of the old class and getting away with this. But at the same time, you know, the PSG were in command of that game to an astonishing degree, really, without capitalising with enough goals. And you know, I think that reflects well on Pochettino. He's had a lot of criticism for some of the flakiness we've seen over the last 18 months from PSG. But yeah, I mean, it's intriguing. You could see Real Madrid getting away with it.
Ian, you mentioned Madrid. I mean, I was looking at some of the stats this morning. We've just discussed Liverpool and City, and you quite rightly say Bayern in there with them. But for me, Madrid, are they not still up there as well? I know they're behind in the tie now, but they're second behind Bayern for chances created in the tournament this season. And they've also conceded the fewest goals, joint with Bayern and Chelsea. So, you know, are they still contenders, or is it this kind of fading giant that is clinging on thanks to the experience of Modric and Casemiro and players like that?
Yeah, I mean the stats is interesting. I didn't know that, and actually, you know, they had a reasonably challenging group. It's not as if they walked through that, and indeed they lost, didn't they, to Sheriff Tiraspol at home, which is not a gauge to judge them. I think in defence of Ancelotti, who is being accused of being cowardly in the approach he took to the game in Paris. Benzema was not fully fit, so it was a risk to play him, and you know he didn't look himself. Slightly more alarmingly, Vinicius was barely visible. I think he was very well marked by Ashraf Hakimi, but it does indicate that when Vinicius, who's had a terrific season, isn't lively and running at people, they can look very quickly rather bland. So. Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, that midfield is, you know, is sort of immortal, isn't it? You can no longer say, oh, Modric is a bit overhill. I can't see him dragging a Real Madrid away, because, you know, he can still do that. There's no doubt. And defensively, they are strong. Courtois had a very good season, given that they've lost Sergio Ramos. The centre halves are generally. Eder Militao and David Alaba have gelled together quite well, but I still wouldn't trust them as much as you wouldn't trust them as much as City, and I wouldn't trust them as much as Liverpool. And I would back Bayern to beat them should that happen.
Interesting. Tom, Kylian Mbappe's performance. I mean, Danny Carvajal probably still having nightmares. Probably will for the next few weeks at least. It's one of those. He was up against a team that he's probably going to join next season. He almost wanted to show the PSG fans what the club meant to him, and that he still sees success in their future together, even if it only lasts the next few months. Is he the best player in the world right now? Is that still Mo Salah for you?
It's still Mo Salah for me. Mbappe is a player that fascinates me, because it's almost like, this is not a criticism, but whenever I watch him and whenever I read about him and think about him in the context of modern football, he seems like one of those players that come along every now and again that is a little bit stuck in that mold of the 18-year-old wonder kid. It's almost like he's always that. And maybe it is that he needs to move to Real Madrid and become a modern Galactico and win loads of trophies, and then he'll be put on the pedestal as the greatest in the world. I don't know. Maybe I've got too much of the old stereotype about PSG and the Farmers League and all that nonsense. But he seems stuck. He produces these wonderful moments at the kind of the highlight reels, the social media clip footballer. But there's something about him that's not quite gone to the next level yet to me. I don't know. I don't know whether I'm wrong. I don't know whether you guys would agree. Ian, I also find it fascinating, this kind of narrative around a player in the modern game. You know, I know we used to have it back in the day where, again, as I said, it felt like Barca and Real were the two big clubs and every player ended up there at some point. In the modern respect, I find it quite fascinating that you have the BT commentators going, he scored for PSG against the team he'll be playing for next season. Is that a done deal? I mean, I don't know. And also, do you guys agree? Is he kind of not quite there? To me, he's not quite reached that top level yet.
I think Tom has hit the nail on the head. I think the two things are absolutely connected. I think there is a part of Kylian Mbappe who feels that at PSG, who he joined when he was still a teenager, that he is still in this space where he is a wonder kid. And I think possibly the nature of PSG, the way it's structured, and the importance of Neymar and now the importance of Messi, it sort of imposes a perception of him as somehow junior. And so I think that is part of the drive for him to move on. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of employees would recognize this phenomenon that you're stuck in the same place for a while. You assume a role and those around you sort of unconsciously put that role on you. So, you know, I think this is a genuine part of the drive to join Real Madrid. And as Tom said, there's a sort of old fashionedness to that as well. You know, it is the great Real Madrid. It may not be the all powerful team in Europe right now, but it is historically the desired, the, you know, awe inspiring club. So, you know, that's been with him for a long time. None of which is to say it's definitely going to happen.
I when it comes to Kylian Mbappe, I think he's still, you know, he's tweeted about it in the past. I think the public perception of the French league suggests that even though he's brilliant, he's done it on the international stage, and he's done it in the Champions League as well, that he can't get that element of greatest player in the world because he's not playing in one of the best leagues in the world. Whether La Liga will answer that question, I don't know. But he's a pretty good player, half decent, gotta say. enjoyed his performance the other night. Big future, the kid. So we'll see where he ends up at next season. Well, we've had a look at the three games in the Champions League so far this week. There was one other. First timers in the knockout stage, RB Salzburg getting a 1-1 draw with Bayern Munich. Konstantin Ekner joins us now to take a look at that game. We'll talk a little bit of Manchester United too. Konstantin, how surprised were you that Salzburg managed to hold on for this result?
A little bit, yes. I still think that Bayern are the clear favorite to beat Salzburg in the return leg. And I mean, I was surprised by Salzburg's performance. As many may know, that they have lost a couple of key players over the past two and a half years. I mean, if you remember Erling Haaland and all these guys have left. And that's a new team, a team with less known players, with a less known coach. But they really showed a Salzburg typical performance, which is, you know, fast play. Playing out of the backfield, pretty speedy and overwhelming opponents a little bit, but still surprising that they were able to overwhelm Bayern during phases of the game. And so I think it was also a fair result in the end. And Salzburg had a chance to actually win it, steal it, make it 2-0, I think 10 minutes before the final whistle. So yeah, I was surprised, but still I was also impressed by Salzburg's performance overall.
We seem to think, we just, you know, it comes out naturally when we talk about the favourites for the Champions League that Bayern Munich will be mentioned. But under Julian Nagelsmann, are they that dominant side that we've seen in the past few years? Of course, under Hansi Flick in particular, winning the Champions League. Is this Bayern at that level?
I think if you take the starting 11 and let's say the best starting 11 they have and maybe three or four substitution players, if everyone is fit, no one has a positive COVID test and so on, I think they still have one of the best teams in Europe and they still are among the favorites, among the two, three, four favorites to win the Champions League. Problem is Bayern's bench is pretty thin. They have a couple of injuries worries. They have players who get tested positive who are out. And that's really the biggest concern right now. We can look back at the past or the latest match in the Bundesliga. They lost 4-2 to VfL Bochum. Bochum is, you know, a lower third table side. They lost convincingly against Bochum. And one of the biggest issues that was discussed afterwards was that most of the players are pretty sure of their starting 11 spot right now. I mean, they don't have to give 100% all the time because they know they will be in the starting 11 next weekend or next Wednesday. So that's a big concern because when you look at the bench, they have a couple of reserve players, youth players. It's pretty thin there. And I think that's really the biggest issue right now Bayern are facing. They didn't do much during the winter transfer window that might hurt them moving forward when it comes to their prospects in the Champions League.
I saw reports this week that Nagelsmann is unhappy with the transfer activity and how the club approached January. Can you understand those frustrations, or because of the strength of Bayern in the Bundesliga, are you more with the club in that they don't really need to invest at a very high level?
I think Nagelsmann reflects what I just said, that really his bench is a concern and he doesn't have much competition within the team right now. So how do you push someone to 95 or 100% if there's no competition for his position or for his spot in the starting 11? So I think that's what Nagelsmann has alluded to. Moreover, Bayern, they have a couple of players right now, Mark Rocca, Corentin Tolisso in midfield, for instance, players who are there, who are expensive, but who don't bring much to the table. And I think the Bayern front office, the hierarchy, they want to get rid of these players first, and then they want to reinvest some money and get new players. It's hard to do that during the winter transfer window when you don't have really a buyer's market, and not a strong buyer's market, and getting rid of players who have been sitting on the bench for most of their stint at Bayern. It's really hard. And also, Bayern, as most clubs in Europe, have been hurt by COVID, and revenue has dropped. revenue streams have died down, at least partially. I mean, Bayern are still a wealthy club, and financially they are still healthy. But still, I mean, even they don't have the big pockets right now to just buy another 50 million player, or buy two or three 30 million players. So that might also be the thought process in Bayern's offices. Nagelsmann, from his coaching perspective, just looked at his team and thinks, well, I need a few more players here to really have competition within the team. I mean, also, just to look back at the early January phase, there were like 4, 5, 6 Bayern players coming back from holiday, all positive, COVID positive, so they were all out of the team. That's how this second half of the season started. So it wasn't really a good start, but it didn't do anything in the rental transfer window. Well, it might hurt them, as I said.
Konstantin, I do want to ask you about one other topic, because when Ralf Rangnick came in at Manchester United, you joined us on the Game podcast to give us the lowdown. So far in the Premier League, he's had 11 games in charge, 6 wins, 4 losses, and 1 defeat. What do you think we've learned about his coaching quality? Do you think he is good enough for Manchester United over the longer term, possibly?
You might change the question a little bit and ask, like, who is good enough for Manchester United right now? Rangnick is a good tactician. He's a thinker. I believe he has shown that already in some games, at least, when you look closely. But I think he's not the most talented man manager or locker room manager. You know, he's not a Jurgen Klopp who can manage a locker room quite well, or seen it done maybe. He's more of a tactician. He has to work with a functional team. What you right now see is that United isn't that kind of functional team he needs. And also there are some players who apparently don't buy into his ideas. But that isn't really Ralf Rangnick's fault. I mean, he is a little bit of a lame duck, because everyone knows that come summer, he won't be the head coach anymore. He will be consultant, but what does that mean really? I mean, we don't know, right? He won't be the sporting director. He won't be the manager. He won't be the chairman of something. So that's really a problem. And I think some players just don't really care about what Ralf Rangnick says. But I think he's really in a difficult spot right now, and most coaches would struggle. And that's really the issue Man United are facing right now. Who's good enough? Who's the coach who will turn this team around? Good luck finding one.
Konstantin Ekner, thank you very much for joining us on the Game podcast this week.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Off Air, the podcast, with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast, now available on the Times radio app.
England's big six clubs have succeeded in fighting off a new owner's charter, with the project mothballed after the Premier League failed to secure universal approval for the proposal. The charter, conceived in response to the short-lived European Super League last April, six clubs joined, but the six clubs, Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool, Spurs and the two Manchester clubs, have now refused to sign it because it would commit to them only qualifying for the Champions League via current sporting merit. Barrett. I read you there an article from the Times chief sports reporter, Martin Ziegler, who joins us on the game now with more on this story. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Hugh.
Firstly, tell us why only getting to the Champions League through current sporting merit sounds like such a bad thing to these clubs.
Well, I think it's a safety net, effectively, that if they don't get into the Champions League through finishing the top four of the Premier League, there's another chance. Now, obviously, this is very controversial because it means, for example, Manchester United could finish sixth and qualify for the Champions League ahead of teams finishing fifth. So, for example, West Ham, because they've never been in the Champions League, they wouldn't have a high coefficient. So Manchester United would effectively leapfrog them. And obviously, that's very controversial.
So the Super League is clearly still on their minds. This is something that a lot of fans are worried about. It's been spoken about. I saw Gary Neville tweeting about it this week. The Super League will be back. What's your sense on it? Not necessarily if it will be back, but it feels more like a when.
I don't think there's any immediate threat of that happening. I think the Premier League have brought in new rules separate to the owner's charter. I mean, they've signed up to a 30-point deduction if they join a breakaway competition again. So that's a massive disincentive. I think there is definitely a sort of power struggle around this sort of European issue. And I think what the Premier League executive is hoping is that UEFA won't actually push ahead with this idea and that it'll save them a problem.
The owner's charter, why do we need it? They're obviously discussing it, but do you think it will be passed? Do you think these clubs will come to some sort of agreement on what it looks like? And for you, what will that be?
So there are some interesting things that clubs will have to sign up to on an annual basis, such as agreeing to a sort of one club, one vote system, supporting the England national team, financial sustainability. But I think what's happened now is also, as well, is that the Tracy Crouch review, the fan-led review of football, has thrown up another load of issues, such as whether there should be an independent regulator. And I think what will happen is we won't see the charter now, and it's all going to be wrapped up into the Premier League's response to the Crouch report. They will accept some things and fight against the idea of having an outside regulator. That's why I think actually the owner's charter in its proposed form will probably never see the light of day.
It's a strange one, isn't it? I mean, we're getting used to it now in British society, people marking their own homework. Should the Premier League be able to influence whether there is an independent regulator or not for you?
Well, I think it's okay for the football clubs to have their views and for those views to be listened to. I do think the Premier League shouldn't be the regulator because at the moment it's in a situation where it often regulates its own clubs, and that's not right. So whether the independent regulator is actually a sort of beefed up football association, that's not which I think the Premier League would go for. I wouldn't say that's the worst idea in the world, but obviously the FA has its own competitions. You've got the FA Cup, so there is another problem there. But I think it's absolutely fine for people to make their views known, but they necessarily shouldn't be the most influential views.
I tend to agree with you on that. Martin Ziegler, thank you for joining us very quickly on the Game Podcast with an update on where the game seems to be going. Appreciate it. Now, staying on European football, it's not just the Champions League this week. The Europa League returned with some fantastic ties and some for us to discuss. I'll come to the others in a few moments. But since, Ian, you're in Barcelona, this tie against Napoli, when it was drawn, looked like it could only be possibly one result, that Napoli would absolutely destroy Barcelona. They had an intriguing January transfer window. Barcelona, this is. How equal, if you like, how level do you think this tie is? Or do you still believe Napoli are going to wipe the floor with the Spanish giants? What do you think?
I think they could do. You know, Napoli are a very strong side, really in contention for the Serie A title. And in a total contrast, in a way, to Barcelona, they have been playing broadly with the same personnel and certainly a similar style for quite a long time. They know what they're doing. Whereas Barcelona, as you say, they have brought in an entire new front three in the transfer window, resourcefully, given that they supposedly haven't got any money. And who knows which of the many strikers, all of them slightly flawed, will line up tonight. It could be the entirely new front three, all of whom came from the Premier League. So I think even Xavi, the manager, is still looking for clarity as to, you know, how best to accommodate these new players. So yeah, I'm intrigued. I think it is on paper a heavyweight tie, which is, you know, glamorizes the Europa League for that. And I think we really don't know what's going to go on. I'm really looking forward to watching Adama Traore playing in a European tie at Camp Nou. He's been terrific since he arrived. But I think overall, over two legs, yeah, you'd have to say Napoli must be the favourite.
Ian, I remember the three of us discussing Barca earlier in the season, and I put it to you whether they were more of a Manchester United situation where they had a big club and just needed the kind of right manager and the right fit, or they were an Arsenal and they were more kind of in the kind of state of building from the bottom up and having to start again. And you suggested they were a bit more like Arsenal. And then they've kind of taken a slightly Manchester United-esque approach to solving it by spending loads of money on lots of players that perhaps don't necessarily work, but let's throw them all on the pitch and see if it happens. How has that been viewed in Spain? Because obviously we see lots of kind of sarcastic social media posts about, oh, where have you got this money from? But I mean, are other teams in uproar? Are they kind of slightly bemused? How is it being viewed, this kind of Barcelona remake?
There has been a little bit of uproar, obviously, from smaller clubs about the way they have got round what was a really restrictive, or if you're from Barcelona, punitive cap on how much they could spend because of their debt, because of the blurring in income and so on. They are coming out of that. You know, Barcelona are a big club, which means there are income streams. It's a matter of degree, but they are coming out of that. And in the meantime, I suppose you could say they have been quite shrewd in the mechanics of, say, getting Aubameyang and getting Traore from Wolves. Now, again, with Barcelona, you know, there's an important presentational aspect. Yes, it does. You know, it does look like a team thrown together. You know, Luc de Jong, not a typical Barcelona player by any means. But remember, Adama Traore is a former La Masia graduate, so he keys into that homegrown thing, which is very, very important presentationally. And behind him, the positives of the season have been the young players promoted from the academy and thriving in midfield. Gavi and Nico, the midfielders particularly. You know, that there were, through certain lenses, this Barcelona are being true to the traditions that they say are important. Around the rest of it, yeah, there's a lot of passing traffic, that's for sure. You know, how long will Aubameyang be there? How long will Luc de Jong be there? I think a lot of purists will say, just as long as he scores a few headed goals before the end of the season, and then he can go. But back to your initial point, I would say still they are slightly more Arsenal than Manchester United.
What happens this summer with Barcelona? I mean, Barcelona will want to come back to the higher stage. Does it matter whether they're in the Champions League or not next season to what the club does? Because they've got, like you say, those brilliant young players. Will they now be, they've brought in some big names. Will they be avoiding them now at all costs? Will they be focused in on those younger players? Did they just bring in the likes of Aubameyang to guarantee Champions League football? And then will they move beyond them?
That's a very good question. And of course, this will partly be defined, because it always is, by what happens at Real Madrid. So, you know, if Mbappe goes to Real Madrid, Barcelona will have to continue to make big noises about Erling Haaland. You know, because you can't possibly be out-trumped by Real Madrid, at least in terms of your presentation. But, you know, they need money, and the Champions League, the difference between the Champions League and the Europa League is very significant. Also, you know, how do you attract very good players if you're not in the Champions League? So all those things are, the Champions League is vital. At the moment, they're fourth, but only by the narrow margin, a very tight fight, which is another reason why the Europa League is important for them. You know, it may be their backdoor there if they can sustain a good run. But yeah, no, I qualifying for the Champions League will absolutely affect their summer.
Elsewhere in the Europa League, I think the Europa League is now, and I'm going to put it out there, in many ways, it is turning into a better competition than the Champions League. Now, I'm not necessarily going to say quality of football, but entertainment, and they are two different things, by the way. I think it might be greater in the Europa League. It feels like there's more jeopardy, there's less predictability, but it also does something that the Champions League was supposed to do. It throws up ties with teams all over Europe. I thought that was the whole point. So instead of seeing English and Italian sides go head to head with the Spanish teams, and I know the Italians haven't been great of late, but it feels like every season you will see big Spanish teams and big English teams play one another. Paris Saint-Germain will play Bayern Munich. You know, it is getting repetitive in that way. I think the Europa League still throws up something a little bit different. I mean, look at these ties. If we carry on with Spain, for example, Leipzig taking on Sociedad, beautiful. Zagreb taking on Sevilla, sensational. Dortmund against Rangers, take me back to 1997. Lazio against Porto, it's 2002 all over again. That is what these tournaments were supposed to be about for me. That's all I'm going to say. Before we talk about some of the ties I just mentioned, does anyone agree with me that the Europa League might be a better competition in that way? Tom, what do you think?
I think you're right if In this moment of the competition, and your argument is particularly helped by matches like Manchester City against Sporting Lisbon, where, and the conversation that we've had already about that competition, where, as you say, it feels like we're all waiting for that dream semi-final, Liverpool v PSG, City v Bayern, you know, that we're waiting for that. And then we'll be saying, wow, wasn't this amazing? So in that sense, and, you know, using your definition of competition in terms of the jeopardy, the intrigue, that this could go anyway. And also, for me, I've talked about this before, these European competitions are a great way of exhibiting new players to us, new players, new managers, new clubs, new styles of football. Even the PSGs and the Bayerns are quite familiar to us now. We're going to learn a lot. If you follow the Europa League from here to its completion, you'll discover loads of exciting players, I'm sure. Loads of new managers, managers who might well be linked with move to the Premier League in the future. So in that sense, I think you're right. It's certainly got a lot more intrigue. And in terms of a competition, in terms of competitiveness, yeah, I think you're right. I think you've got a good case there, Hugh.
Yeah, well, I think you've sold this round superbly with your Liverpool ties. And they are. Oh, I'm going to stay in for that. Most of them. The only thing I would say is actually, while the Champions League last 16 at the moment does look very sort of, you know, English heavy and you know, possibly a little predictable, it is unusually open by very recent standards. You know, Salzburg have given us the least expected results so far. Ajax look, you know, genuinely potential semi-finalists. Villarreal are still in it. So I think it's a slightly more diverse Champions League last 16 in some ways, but also the change of format for the Europa League, now that you have this, you know, the round we've got this week, which is in a sense a qualifier to get to join the likes of West Ham and big clubs like that later on, has sort of condensed the glamour of it, I think, at this stage.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and look, there are some big teams still in the Europa League, but I think one of the interesting things about it is actually just, you know, the names in the hat. I just think there are always going to be 12 to 16 teams in the Champions League every single year, guaranteed. And the fact that some teams that finish, you know, might be fifth, sixth, seventh in their league, maybe second, third in other divisions, it seems to change more regularly. So actually, you know, you just get teams who may have never been in Europe in the Europa League one year. You see grounds, you see fans that maybe you don't see, and it has that element of uniqueness that I think maybe the Champions League might be missing a little bit because of that familiarity with the grounds and the clubs and the big brands and the big names.
Ian, Hugh obviously mentioned some of the Spanish teams in there, Sevilla and Sociedad, and I kind of talked about some potential for us to discover new names, new players. Have either of those teams got young players or players that have finally kind of showing their talent that we should be keeping an eye out?
Those two, I mean, just back to the, you know, the wonderful variety of the Europa League, which, you know, which is true. Sevilla are the club who have tried to make the Europa League as predictable as possible over the years.
Yeah, that's true.
By winning it again and again and again. They, I mean, the Turner, you know, Sevilla are a modern miracle for their clever use of the transfer market. So there's always a bit of turnover there. But in essence, their strengths are still around those players who won the Europa League in 2021. No, 2020, beg your pardon, when Manchester United got to the semis. So, I mean, we know about Jules Koundé being a very admired and capable and very versatile defender. He's important. They've got a terrific goalkeeper in Bono. And they have this, you know, this sort of Moroccan core of the team, Bono and the Nassiri up front. Sociedad are a lovely story. They've been getting better and better over a period now, some of the impetus from that coming from when David Silva joined. And, it, you know, you'll remember Adnan Yanasai being a good young player once in England, and he's still quite a young player, and he still does useful things, sometimes off the bench. But
Dortmund against Rangers is one that I think a lot of British football fans will be watching out for, because they want to see what Jude Bellingham is up to, and loads of interesting young players. Do you rank them amongst the favourites for the Europa League, Dortmund?
Yeah, you would say so. I would say overall, over the last, 10 years probably since they were in the final, they've been slightly disappointing as a European force, Dortmund. But given that they're not going to win the Bundesliga again, and I think that the period where they believe they might win the Bundesliga might be even shorter this year. Yeah, you would fancy them. And they do, you know, they do have a really good core of young players led by Bellingham. So, they have to be among the favourites. I think Rangers will give them a reasonably tough game.
Something for us to look forward to, I think, in the Europa League this season. The players emerging, though, I thought that was an interesting point that you mentioned, Tom. So very, very quickly, Ian, I just wondered who'd caught your eye outside of the traditional massive clubs, might be playing Europa League, might even be playing Europa Conference League, that maybe we should be looking out for as we go into these next set of European games.
For people who haven't watched Barca a lot, Gavi, who really is only 6 months into his senior career, he's been a terrific midfielder, and he's very watchable as well. I mean, he's got a lovely touch and so on, but he's very, very feisty for a 17, maybe 18 now year old. You know, he puts his foot in, and he has a long career of success, and I think probably quite a few yellow cards as well. So he's one to look out for. With Dortmund, there are those teenagers coming through who got a start early. Gio Reyna would be another one, son of Claudio. I think they're probably ready for him now to make the next step up, but he's a lovely player to watch.
Well, Ian, thank you very much. Something for us to look out for in European football this week. Loads for us to react to. We've got Premier League coming up at the weekend, in particular Leeds taking on Manchester United. But thank you very much. We'll have more European football next week as well. Ian Hawkey for joining us from Spain, and Tom Clark, thank you very much as well. And to all of you for listening, remember, if you enjoy the Game podcast, make sure you leave us a review. Otherwise, make sure you're subscribed to The Times and The Sunday Times for more of our award-winning journalism. Sign up today, you'll get yourself 1 month free. It's thetimes.co.uk/thegame, and we'll see you on Monday.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.